Chapter 6. State of suspense. You are his friend and you can feel for me. Remain yours truly, Dottis. Even without Peacock's testimony, that her whole aspect and demeanor were manifest emanations of a pure and truthful nature, we should hold this to be a truthful letter, a sincere letter, a loving letter. It bears those marks. I think it is also the letter of a person accustomed to receiving letters from her husband frequently, and that they have been of a welcome and satisfactory sort to this long time back, ever since the solemn remarriage and reconciliation at the altar most likely. The biographer follows Harriet's letter with a conjecture. He conjectures that she old now gladly have retraced her steps, which means that it is proven that as he had steps to retrace, proven by the poem. Well, if the poem is better evidence than the letter, we must let it stand at that. Then the biographer attacks Harriet Shelley's honor by authority of random and unverified gossip scavengered from a group of people whose very names make a person shudder. Mary Godwin, mistress to Shelley, her part sister, discarded mistress of Lord Byron. Godwin, the philosophical tramp, who gathers his share of it from a shadow, that is to say, from a person whom he shirks out of naming. Yet the biographer dignifies this sorry rubbish with the name of Vidance. Nothing remotely resembling a distinct charge from a named person professing to know is offered among this precious Vidance. 1. Helly believed so and so. 2. Byron's discarded mistress says that Shelley told Mary Godwin so and so, and Mary told her. 3. Helly said so and so and later admitted over and over again that he had been in error. 4. The unspeakable Godwin wrote to Mr. Baxter that he knew so and so from unquestionable authority, name not furnished. How any man in his right mind could bring himself to defile the grave of a shamefully abused and defenseless girl with these baseless fabrications, this manufactured filth, is inconceivable. How any man, in his right mind, or out of it, could sit down and coldly try to persuade anybody to believe it, or listen patiently to it, or, indeed, do anything but scoff at it and deride it, is astonishing. The charge insinuated by these odious slanders is one of the most difficult of all offenses to prove. It is also one which no man has a right to mention even in a whisper about any woman, living or dead, unless he knows it to be true, and not even then, unless he can also prove it to be true. There is no justification for the abomination of putting this stuff in the book. Against Harriet Shelley's good name there is not one scrap of tarnishing evidence, and not even a scrap of evil gossip, that comes from a source that entitles it to a hearing. On the credit side of the account we have strong opinions from the people who knew her best. Peacock says, "Feel it due to the memory of Harriet to state my most decided conviction that her conduct as a wife was as pure, as true, as absolutely faultless, as that of any who for such conduct are held most in honor." Thornton Hunt, who had picked and published slight flaws in Harriet's character, says, as regards this alleged large one, "Here is not a trace of evidence, or a whisper of scandal against her before her voluntary departure from Shelley." Trelawney says, "Was assured by the evidence of the few friends who knew both Shelley and his wife, Hookham, Hogg, Peacock, and one of the Godwins, that Harriet was perfectly innocent of all offense. What excuse was there for raking up a parcel of foul rumors from malicious and discredited sources and flinging them at this dead girl's head? Her very defenselessness should have been her protection. The fact that all letters to her are about her, with almost every scrap of her own writing, had been diligently mislaid, leaving her case destitute of a voice, while every pen stroke which could help her husband's side had been as diligently preserved, should have excused her from being brought to trial. Her witnesses have all disappeared, yet we see her summoned in her grave clothes to plead for the life of her character, without the help of an advocate, before a disqualified judge and a packed jury." Harriet Shelley wrote her distressed letter on the 7th of July. On the 28th, her husband ran away with Mary Godwin and her part sister Claire to the continent. He deserted his wife when her confinement was approaching. She bore him a child at the end of November. His mistress bore him another one something over 2 months later. The truants were back in London before either of these events occurred. On one occasion, presently, Shelley was so pressed for money to support his mistress with, that he went to his wife and got some money of his that was in her hands, £20. Yet the mistress was not moved to gratitude. For later, when the wife was troubled to meet her engagements, the mistress makes this entry in her diary. Harriet sends her creditors here. Nasty woman. Now we shall have to change our lodgings. The deserted wife bore the bitterness and obloquy of her situation 2 years and a quarter. Then she gave up and drowned herself. A month afterwards the body was found in the water. 3 weeks later Shelley married his mistress. I must here be allowed to italicize a remark of the biographers concerning Harriet Shelley. Had no act of Shelley's during the 2 years which immediately preceded her death tended to cause the rash act which brought her life to its close seems certain. Yet her husband had deserted her and her children, and was living with a concubine all that time. Why should a person attempt to write biography, when the simplest facts have no meaning to him? This book is littered with as crass stupidities as that one, deductions by the page which bear no discoverable kinship to their premises. The biographer throws off that extraordinary remark without any perceptible disturbance to his serenity, for he follows it with a sentimental justification of Shelley's conduct which has not a pang of conscience in it, but a silky and smooth and undulating, and pious, a cakewalk with all the colored brethren at their best. There may be people who can read that page and keep their temper, but it is doubtful. Shelley's life has the one indelible blot upon it, but is otherwise worshipfully noble and beautiful. It even stands out indestructibly gracious and lovely from the ruck of these disastrous pages, in spite of the fact that they expose and establish his responsibility for his forsaken wife's pitiful fate, a responsibility which he himself tacitly admits in a letter to Eliza Westbrook, wherein he refers to his taking up with Mary Godwin as an act which Eliza might excusably regard as the cause of her sister's ruin. End of this Project Gutenberg, a text of defense of Harriet Shelley by Mark Twain. MTDHS by Gutenberg Edition.